Well, we hope you're getting around just fine on this Aloha Friday. Good day to you. Glad you could join us. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Welcome to The Conversation. And hello there, Chris Vandercook.
Hi, Beth Ann. You know, the new federal policy on immigration has special resonance for Hawaii. It seems kind of appropriate that the state was the first to act.
Exactly, and why we're going to talk about it this morning. Next week, you know, President Trump's latest executive order on immigration and travel is set to go into effect. But hours before it does, a federal judge will hear Hawaii's challenge to block it. Our state is the first to sue over the new immigration and travel ban. Hawaii's Attorney General Douglas Chin says there are two key sections that are unconstitutional and not consistent with federal law. He's in our studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. When word came that there would be a second executive order, there were folks who were sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop to see whether this, in fact, would be challenged as well. When did you know that you were going to challenge this, or did you prepare in advance?
You know, I could actually back up 1 week before, where I was actually in D.C. It was last week, the national attorneys general all got to meet President Trump. And so I was able to ask him about the upcoming travel ban and what he expected to accomplish from it. And so his response was that he wanted to make America safe again. It involved extreme vetting. A lot of us probably wouldn't like it, but this is what he felt like he had to do. Not much detail, but that's what he talked about.
Somewhat of the usual rhetoric, but in terms of how you were able to question him, you got nothing more from him other than that?
No, and to be fair, it wasn't that kind of environment. It was a Q&A. I was lucky to get one question in, but it was an important one. Later on, when the executive order came out earlier, it was this week. I think what concerned us was that it's the same ban on from entry from Muslim-majority countries. It's the same shutdown of refugee admissions. It's more neutral language. But I think the problem for us, and I think why it hits home for Hawaii, is that Hawaii is a place where discrimination against people based on national origin or religion is just a dark path that we don't want to go down.
You've said, and you've been quoted as saying, that this is simply the same thing dressed up differently. But in so doing, to talk about some of the details of why this is so onerous to people, not just in Hawaii, but in general, looking at sections 2 and 6.
Sure. You know, I think what makes it so problematic and different from other executive orders, and I realize this is just our argument. Others, the U.S. might try to say something different, but what's happening is this is the first time a president in the last 50 years has violated the Immigration and Nationality Act. In other words, what it says right now is that if you are from one of these six, used to be seven, but if you're from these six countries, you're presumptively a terrorist. And that is a nationality-based classification that was eliminated by Congress back in 1965, 1 year before I was born, actually. That kind of classification based on countries was taken away. And now for the first time after all the different presidents that we've had, R&D, we now have this kind of classification, and that's not going to be acceptable.
You mentioned a little earlier that particularly in Hawaii, this is something that most people find repulsive, the
right
idea that we would judge someone based on ethnicity.
Right. Well, the timing couldn't be any worse. I mean, 75 years ago, it was President Roosevelt, and for national security reasons, he put out an executive order that required Japanese-American, Italian-Americans, German-Americans, even citizens of that ethnicities to be placed in internment camps. And it's really chilling, actually, to read back that when you look at the executive order, a lot of the reasoning behind it was grounded in fear. It was based upon the idea that you can't trust everybody from that country, and so therefore you need to do something about all of them. And I think we all want safety and security in the country, for sure. But there's just got to be a way to do it that's not unconstitutional
or draconian.
Right.
Unlike 75 years ago, though, we have many more people who are involved in business, in education, in tourism. who are much more mobile than they ever were then, and who are here engaged in various endeavors and need to be able to move about freely. That right. seemed to be also one of the legs that you were standing on in saying that this bill, that this executive order right. really was unconstitutional.
If you don't mind, I'd just love to share, I think one of the blessings that's come out of this lawsuit is it's actually given me the opportunity to meet the Muslim community that's here in Hawaii. And they are great people. You know, they have kids that go to our schools. They work great jobs. They contribute to the university environment. There's a Persian language and culture studies program at the university. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people that come from the Middle East and Africa every single year to travel to Hawaii that could be discouraged by this travel ban.
Is there any real coincidence that, as you know, one of the leads on the challenge to the executive order, that you chose Neil Katyal? I mean, he seems to have a long history with Hawaii back in the days of being able to be working on behalf of those detainees in Guantanamo. Also, the fact that he has been very critical of what happened in the 1940s with Japanese internment.
Right. When Neil Katyal was the acting solicitor general under the Obama administration, he had actually issued an apology or just a kind of a take back of some of the decisions that were previously made by the Department of Justice against Japanese American citizens, and that really meant a lot. And so certainly when we were trying to look for people to help us in areas that are really outside of our expertise, he was a natural selection.
At this point, when we're sort of waiting to see what's going to happen next week, other states have also joined the challenge, looking to see what, in fact, if it's, certainly the Trump administration thinks that this is going to survive whatever challenge, or that it's perfectly
sure.
legal. But how does this continue a conversation and a narrative that we aren't really looking at what's best for the country for everyone? We're only looking at it through a very narrow lens.
Right. I got to say, the first priority is to make sure that we, my job is to legally object. If I see a problem in the Constitution or a problem with the laws, and especially when they butt up against the state, I have to object. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. But I think even beyond that, if this is where you're going, I really think this is an opportunity for different groups that have been disenfranchised to speak up. One of the things that really hit me from attending the 75th anniversary activities that had commemorated what happened with the Japanese internments that were occurring a couple weeks ago, well, it was just the constant chorus of the fact that what really hurt the people who were interned was the silence. And to me, what I see that just matters more is that we have to speak up against what we see as something that is it's damaging our society. It's a very divisive type of narrative that is not appropriate and not something we want.
So even if the challenge doesn't survive, the fact that it could be also construed as a call to action
right.
would also be something that would please you?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to get a good result. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to be able to speak up and let the president, let the Congress know that that people are watching what they do.
Douglas Chin will also be watching. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
Douglas Chin is Attorney General for the state of Hawaii. Hawaii was the first state to file suit over the revised executive order on immigration. Several other states have also filed to join that lawsuit, including New York, Washington, Oregon, and Minnesota.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a visit from the Hawaiian-style band. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking through the lens at wartime Hawaii. The Second World War brought martial law to the islands, and for workers on island sugar plantations, strikes and workforce protests became illegal. But discontent was growing among those workers. They wanted to be paid in cash and allowed to choose their own housing. Common practice in the generations-old plantation economy was to provide workers with housing for which the workers paid, and they were also sold goods at the company store. The arrangement favored owners and kept the labor force dependent. Not long after war's end, a 1946 strike changed all of that forever. Your quiz today, what was the name of the labor union and its charismatic leader who took more than 21,000 workers off the job and onto the picket lines? Make sure to name both the person and the organization. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and we'll send you a prize from our company store if you're right.
By the time the Hawaiian Style Band released its debut album, Vanishing Treasures, 25 years ago, contemporary Hawaiian music had come of age and was well on its way to incorporating styles from far distant musical genres, reflecting a new sensibility in both sound and subject matter. Brian Kessler and Wade Camburn are founding members of the band here in our studio to perform and share some of the ideas that got them going. Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Wade.
Aloha. Good morning. Good morning. Nice to be here.
Brian, I'm kind of thinking of where the local music scene was when you guys started out, and you know the style known as contemporary Hawaiian was in place by then, right? Lots of influences around for you guys.
It was just in the beginning stages, I think. We had Brother Walter that was sort of doing a reggae-ish kind of a...
Right.
They started calling it Jawaiian.
Right.
I started calling it Jawaiian because, you know, obvious reasons, but... That was all that was really happening, and that was huge music, and,
yeah.
And that sort of ushered in the change a little bit, which was real different than the C&K Kalapana kind of
right.
a sound years before, and we basically started developing that sound from a couple of commercials that we were working on mm-hmm. at the time, Hawaiian Style Clothing and Local Motion Clothing,
uh-huh.
And we had this commercial that was just all over the airwaves called Ainana Local Motion that people were calling up and going, what is that? We want to buy that record. Where can we get it? It's a commercial. And that's kind of, we kind of went with that. And I remember getting together with Bla Pahanui. He helped us a little bit on that first album. He said, you know what? That beat is really something.
Yeah.
You should really write some more songs around that beat. And
yeah.
I think that kind of resonated with both Wade and I.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that piece we heard just before we started talking, where the way the drum was mixed into that. There's a big
yes.
boom on the tom-tom.
Yes,
know.
Yes.
That wouldn't have been part of Hawaiian music maybe a decade earlier.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Those early tunes were drum loops and drum machines mm-hmm. before we added the live guys to copy what we had done with
right.
the drum loops. Yeah.
I think it's also interesting to note that... you know, both Brian and I had been playing around town quite a bit in top 40 groups.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, both Paul Simon, his Graceland album, and Sting were popular.
Mm-hmm.
And we very much allowed those sounds, those songs to influence what we were doing with contemporary Hawaiian music. We would use a Hawaiian song and give it a different beat. And arrangement, too.
Mm-hmm.
We used a lot of arrangement protocols that came up in these songs by these other artists.
That's a good point, Wade, because that really is, you know, Paul Simon went to Africa and recorded his album with all the local guys there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think was a thing worldwide in music of people opening their ears to, you know, sounds from continents away. as opposed to sticking to this is what you're supposed to do in instrumentation, rhythm, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Case in point, our song Living in a Sovereign Land, when the guitar part comes in the middle of that, it's right out of the Graceland album. It's that African kind of guitar part that's mixed with the lopey kind of groove with the slack keyish guitars all kind of mixed in there.
You know,
and that created that sort of more worldish kind of a feeling, you know.
Well, you know, I think back to the days when you'd go in the record store and there'd be these compartments, right? Each one labeled with, you know, with this is jazz, this is blues, this is country, and, you know, let not the twain ever meet.
Right?
It was, yeah. It was everyone in his ghetto kind of thing.
But yeah.
That kind of broke down, didn't it, Wade? In that years, right around the time you guys were getting started.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, like Brian said, we incorporated some new sounds. We got some recognition from a guy named Robbie Burns, who put together Locomotion Clothing Company. He kind of recognized that there was an opening here, and he came up with the name Hawaiian Style Band, and I wrote Live a Little Hawaiian Style, and that was really our starting point for all of this. And we won the Hoku for the single of the year in, I think it was 1990?
Yeah.
91 was the awards, and it was for the year of 1990. And after that experience, you know, we all just kind of looked at each other and said, let's do a whole album.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to more of what we were already doing. And you mentioned Sovereign Land because I think I speak for myself that I learned a lot about local issues and Hawaiian issues that were going on. So it was a learning experience for me at the time. I enrolled at KCC and took a language course, and you know, I really wanted to jump into even the Hawaiian culture, even though I'd been here for several years already. I really listened, you know, to a lot more music at that point, Hawaiian music.
And, you know, and you guys, of course, brought in musical skills from other genres as well, which was clearly going to influence how the music.
Yes, we were the two Hali guys, you know. From people knew our music before they knew what we looked like.
Right.
You know, and it was incredible.
Probably just as well.
Yeah, right. We do these concerts and they go, you were the guys that did all that? Because we had some great guest artists with us on the first album.
Yeah.
We had Brada Iz and Del Beasley and Teresa Bright. Mm-hmm. And they were playing all those songs on the radio. And it was all the same group, but all those songs were being played. So when we finally got out there and started performing, it was a real eye-opener for us as well as the people who were watching us.
A certain amount of disbelief.
Yeah.
But, you know, even with the, you know, sort of innovative approach to accepting other influences in terms of what you were saying in your lyrics, there was lots of let's return to local style. That had a very traditional bent to it. There's a real appreciation of local life. And that's kind of a look back to the good old days.
Yes, absolutely.
I did take the opportunity, too, in my writing, I developed kind of a snapshot of local life. You know, what I saw, what I observed, what I learned, I tried to put to song. You know, with the exception of maybe a love song like Love and Honesty, that did bring in some local elements, imagery and so forth. There's a lot to write about here in Hawaii.
Well, that's you've proven that ever since, and we're going to hear your music in the second half of the show, but thanks so much.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Brian Kessler and Wade Cambern are founding members of the Hawaiian Style Band. They'll be performing at the Blue Note Hawaii Saturday, March 25th, and they'll be back in the second half of our show with Roby Kahakalau to play some of their tunes.
There's a moon in the sky over Diamond Head, and it shines down on Waikiki. By the light of the night, their two lovers wed, the sweetest of memories.
A hike in military spending could mean a long-time boon for Hawaii and the Pearl Harbor shipyard. But will Hawaii residents like what they get? Civil Beat reporter Kirsten Downey joins us today from Washington, D.C. Good morning to you. Let's talk about what it might be like if Hawaii actually sees a lot more military spending and, in fact, becomes a hub of activity at the shipyard.
Well, it's really interesting. There's been a lot of talk about expanding the U.S. naval fleet, and of course that's very important to us in Hawaii because we are home of the U.S. Pacific Command. This week we saw the first action moving in that direction. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a $578 billion defense bill that included a $7 million boost in procurement of fighter jets and helicopters and also 13 new ships.
We've talked in past about what kind of shape a lot of the fleet is in now. A lot of it dates back to the 1980s, really in need of repair, and also technology has advanced. What more might come to Hawaii? You just mentioned 13 ships, but in terms of time frame and jobs, what are we looking at?
Well, we're talking about like a 30-year time frame. It takes a long time to build a ship. The positives about this, which our congressional delegation is enthusiastic about, are that it's good for the economy. It brings construction spending. It brings increased employment. It also brings the prospect, because of that long time, the 30-year time frame, these are going to be really good jobs for Hawaii's kids over a lifetime. So those are the positives. The negatives, though, are potential environmental impacts, the fact that some people don't want to see an expanded military presence in Hawaii, and the fact that increasing defense spending will inevitably lead to cuts in other areas, other things that we also value as a culture, environmental protection, education, housing programs.
Our congressional delegation, though, seems to truly believe that there is a threat from Russia and China, which are also building their navies pretty quickly.
Well, this is a new state of affairs for the United States. We haven't had any real potential military threat from any place in the world since the Second World War. But one of the studies that the Congress and the Senate are thinking about right now showed that the Chinese now have 63 attack submarines. The U.S. only has 54.
And that's just one of the statistics that you're looking at that shows that there's a disparity between what the U.S. has, what Russia has, what China has. And I guess we'll have to wait and see how this goes. Clearly, understanding the position of the military in Hawaii and what that means going forward, both positive and negative, we'll be talking about that in future. Good to talk to you again, Kirsten.
Well, thank you so much.
Kirsten Downey reports for Civil Beat in Washington, D.C. It's a Friday, and of course, one of the things we do is take a look at what our news department is working on that we'll all be listening to next week. And here to help us with that, Bill Dorman, HPR's news director. And here we are midway through the legislative session. Money is going to be increasingly more important as we decide how, or lawmakers decide how they're going to carve it up.
Busy time. Budget crossover next week. So the money goes into focus on a sharper focus, because it never goes away, but on several fronts. Monday, the revised forecast from the Council of Revenues. This is sort of the number that a lot of folks are looking at. This is the projected growth in tax revenue that the state is expecting. And while we are still talking about growth, those numbers have come down quite a bit from what they were. In September, expectations for 5.5% growth. By January, those down to 3%. So now this number coming out on Monday getting a lot of attention, because a lot of what comes after depends on that. So much hinges on that. And we'll see more of the framework evolving through the week on the budget discussion. Wayne Yoshioka is going to be covering all of that. A big part of this year's discussion, of course, rail We'll be getting tax collection numbers later in the week, which are the actual numbers that are backward-looking that we actually have. So that will, again, add more specifics and evidence, if you will, to sort of the discussions that will continue.
It's always tough when we get some of these numbers that are sort of, you know, in arrears, because trying to use a projection going forward based on what you knew at a certain point in time in the past, and then things change in the interim, it's very, very difficult to do.
Economists a lot of times talk about it, liken it to driving a car, and there are certain figures that you get that are looking out the windshield, and there are certain figures that you're looking in the rear view mirror, and you have to put together the reality of what that means. But hey, it's not just all numbers.
No.
There got a story about water on the Big Island coming next week, which is kind of interesting. Water wells on the west side of the Big Island, one of these stories that have been going on literally for years in terms of concerns about that, with varying degrees of urgency, honestly. And now the urgency has been dialed up a little bit. County Water Department has 7 wells on the west side. 4 of them are down right now in terms of repairs. So water usage cut back, that's a short-term way to address this. Longer-term question is what happens about this strategy going ahead. Sherry Bracken's going to be talking with the County Department of Water about that. And we'll be interested to hear what some of the answers come back.
And briefly before you go, we're in the middle now. We're just starting off with the Honolulu Bicentennial.
The biennial, sorry, not the art. Boy, I tell you, if you're out there as a listener, want to get involved in art, check out Noe Tanigawa's piece on the Honolulu Biennial. She'll be having more coming next week in terms of public and private art. But what's on the website right now is a great overview and an opportunity to jump right in.
And make some great weekend plans.
Definitely so.
Because it is the biennial.
It's true.
All right. Thank you, Bill Dorman, HPR's news director. Also on a Friday, we also take a look at what you've sent us in the past week or so.
After yesterday's discussion of Senate Bill 1312 on Town Square, Rachel Strumpf of Kailua Kona said this bill not only criminalizes the majority of our state's home birth midwives, but is also a violation of a mother's civil liberties to choose the person who attends her. Body sovereignty is of the utmost importance.
Now, that same bill touched a nerve with Rose Darling from Kahului, Maui, who told us on Facebook, SB 1312 SD2 will criminalize and penalize traditional midwives who don't have the credentials and requirements as specified in the bill. The coursework isn't available in Hawaii, and it's very costly. These traditional midwives are filling the void in many neighbor island communities, and where there are severe doctor shortages, and most importantly, provide women with a choice about how they want to labor.
After Wednesday's segment with Senator Josh Green on his effort to pay for homeless services using Medicaid, Andrea DeCosta said this on Twitter: housing is health care. HMSA, OHA, and KS won't admit it, but is their collective kuleana to get this job done.
Thanks for all the feedback. If you want to provide us anything else, as if you have a mind to do, you can always call our talk back line. That number is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Every legislative session, prison reform is on the agenda, in great part due to two reasons: the continued advocacy of criminal justice reformers and the fact that Oahu's correctional facility is overcrowded and falling apart. Midway through this legislative session, the questions about where a new facility, or in the case of one bill still alive, where multiple correctional sites around Hawaii might be, Well, they're still persisting. Kat Brady of Community Alliance on Prisons believes that before we settle on sites, we should agree on the system, and that includes on programs to provide skills, education, and proper ID for inmates before they're released. Kat Brady joins us now. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure, Beth Ann. Good morning.
Let's talk about HB 462, which would establish a new billion-dollar prison, also upgrade those facilities around the state. You say this is a bad, bad, bad bill.
Yes, it's confusing. It kind of came out of nowhere because when the session started, it was all about OCCC, the Oahu's jail, and it was about replacing Oahu's jail and finding a location for that. Actually, the planning of that has just been really disastrous, not unlike what's happening with the rail system. It's just that they can't, the department can't seem to decide what they want. Do they want a new jail where 51% of the people as of November 30th in OCCC were pretrial? 51% of the population? Outrageously expensive. And then a bill was introduced that would suspend the EIS process for OCCC. They've already allocated $5.4 million in one session for design and siting and $5 million in a subsequent session. So they've already allocated $10.4 million for OCCC, a jail, a new jail on Oahu. And then this bill 462 emerges, which basically says suspend that. Instead, we want to build a 3,000-bed prison that would house everybody from community custody all the way to maximum custody. And at first, the bill identified Wayava, the site at Wayava, where the minimum security correctional facility is now. That land was state government land. It was turned over to the state a couple of years ago. It's 197 acres. So
Kat, I mean, as we've been hearing from the Department of Public Safety about where this prison might be, where it might find a home, there are meetings that have been happening, but is the community truly involved in coming back to
the No, and the meetings safety? Have all been about OCCC. They haven't really been talking about the prison. So it's very kind of strange because we've got this money allocated for a jail. Then midstream, they say, wait a minute, maybe we should be doing a prison. And what the community is saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe you should think about what we're doing. So there is a task force, the HCR 85 task force that the legislature enacted last year. And that task force is actually tasked with reforming the system, looking at who's in the system, figuring out who should be there, what are better things to do. We had a delegation that went to Norway, and they came back, and they saw a system that is running well, that has a 20% recidivism rate, where ours is, you know, 50 to 60%.
So what's preventing the, you know, as you would put it, sort of the logic of looking at what kind of system do you want, and then what do you need to be able to fulfill that system?
Well, I guess, you know, I would have to use a Latin term, cui bono, who benefits from this? It seems like the beneficiaries are the consultants, because we've already spent almost $14 million on Maui, and for a new facility, and nothing has happened. We now have $10.4 million allocated for OCCC, and they're talking about a prison. So it's there's a cognitive dissonance going on. They can't figure out what they want to do. And we're saying, hey, wait a minute, the state is talking about building, building, building. So the community kind of got together and started a group called the Community Justice Coalition. And that coalition has held two community justice dialogues. And it was so amazing because where the state's talking about bricks and mortar, people are talking about people, their families. That's who's we're talking about, who's incarcerated, members of our family.
So as that continues and trying to get some shape around how do you serve people, at what level do they need to be served? You mentioned having 51% of those who are in OCCC for pretrial.
Yes.
And looking at do they really need to be there in a place that you know clearly needs a great deal of help because it's falling apart. That's been one of the issues. But looking at the in totality, what kind of prison system, what kind of system do we want, period, in the way we help people to be rehabilitated, hopefully, and be able to reenter society and not, you know, turn into another recidivism statistic?
Yeah. Well, you know, you really have to look at the whole system. And the whole system, we have about 5,800 people in now. 74% of those people are in for the lowest felony, usually residue in a pipe or something like that.
And you have to ask, why are they there? Couldn't they be someplace else and not spend so much of our money to keep them housed there? But when they are going to be getting out and they are going to be reentering society, also you are heavily advocating for bills that would give them skills, specifically agricultural skills,
yes,
and also make sure that they have all the proper ID so they can find a job.
Yes. And right now, people are released with no money and no ID. Hawaii is the only state that doesn't have an agreement with the Social Security Administration. And Social Security is kind of the basis of most identification documents that are necessary.
So at this point, you are obviously continuing to advocate for these bills, and we'll see if they move over and how well they are received. They have already moved over, but how well they're received in the Senate and whether this continues.
Well, it'll be interesting after the billion-dollar rail fail. We'll see if we'll have a billion-dollar jail fail and a prison fail.
Bottom line, how do you want to spend your money?
Yeah.
And what kind of system do you want to see for the next 50 or possibly 100 years? We got to go. I'm sorry, but we'll talk again as we go forward. Kat Brady is an organizer with Community Alliance on Prisons. It's a community initiative working to develop effective interventions for Hawaii's offenders and to improve the quality of justice in Hawaii.
Aloha, I'm Marcia Rose Joyner. If you like today's music, go to the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org for a playlist.
In today's quiz, we asked you about the sugar workers' strike in September of 1946. It wasn't just any strike. It was the first one of the post-World War II era when martial law had made protests illegal. Among other things, it forever ended the policy of paying workers with housing and credit at the company store. The strike lasted 79 days and all but shut down the sugar industry, with heated emotions on both sides. Labor organizers were accused of being communist sympathizers, and that was a potent charge in those days. Despite the risks, more than 21,000 workers who walked off the job under the banner of the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, the ILWU, stood fast with their leader, Jack Hall. He was determined to break the power of the so-called Big Five, and the strike was a major victory and turning point in Hawaii labor relations.
This was a very, very popular quiz with lots of different answers, Chris, but the woman who got it right was Janet Murphy, called us from Kailua, and will be receiving the prize. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and we just might use it for a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com.
In the first half of our show, Brian Kessler and Wade Camburn gave us some of the background to their formation of the Hawaiian Style Band 25 years ago. Now, with Roby Kahakalau joining them, we asked him to stick around and perform some of their favorite tunes. Thanks for coming back, you guys.
Hey, you're welcome.
What have you got for us?
Well, we're going to do a song called Old Style Way.
Okay, sounds fair enough.
One, two, three.
In a stone wood house, in the cool green shade, at the foot of the mountain, so far away, sits a barefoot boy, there born and raised, singing songs in the old style way. In the old style way, life was so sweet. It didn't take a lot of money just to make ends meet. With the love of a girl and a little bit of faith, there's a lot you can say for the old style way.
As he works the land,
works the land,
sows the seed,
sows the seed
that grows in
grows into
his
destiny.
And then his heart,
and
he won't forget where he began.
In the old style way, life was so simple then, unlike today, in a world gone mad, where eyes warm and bright turn cold and gray. Still I can dream old style way.
By the light of the moon, she comes to watch him play as he sings to her the story of the love. The night ends too soon, he wishes she would stay as his eyes see stars up above.
You can say for the old style way. In the old style way, life was so simple then, unlike today, in a world gone mad, where eyes warm and bright turn cold and gray. Still I can dream in the old style.
Terrific. Thanks, you guys. How long ago was that song written?
1993, maybe 94.
93, yeah.
Because I was thinking, when, especially the lyric about with the world gone mad, it could have been written yesterday. That's the thing about songs that last, right?
Good songs, right? That's why they last.
You can plug them into any period of time.
It's only getting madder.
Great. So,
sure.
So what's the role of the artist in all that, you know, in a world gone mad?
Yes.
What Roby, what can you do, you know?
get mad along with it, or I don't know. You know when they say you can fight it or join them, but I think if you just try and make the best out of the situation, then and keep smiling,
yeah,
and try not to, you know, take it too serious and hope for the best.
Hey, we've only got less than a minute left, but you want to give us a little taste of a song, and then we'll just kind of fade you down.
Sure.
You pick one.
Okay.
Deeper in Love, Going to Hyena.
Okay. You got it.
We're going to start this in the middle of the song so we can fade it out.
Okay.
Okay. How does that song go now?
Deeper in love.
There it is.
You wrote the song too.
Deeper in love. Haina iamai anda kapuana oku ano hano.
The Hawaiian Style Band will celebrate the 25th anniversary of its debut album, Vanishing Treasures, with a performance at Blue Note Hawaii Saturday, March 25th. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
As we head in the weekend, there are any number of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama, looks at us, giving us for a look at events going on in our community under the radar.
Yes.
Hey,
yes.
Derek.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
All right.
Okay.
One of the Hawaiian Style Band songs is called Give Away, which kind of fits your first.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you can make your own tomorrow. Make your own Hawaiian Style head lay for free and take it home. It's happening at the Hawaii State Art Museum between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. downtown. All ages are welcome, and all materials are provided thanks to the Hawaii Hand Weavers Hui. Drop in any time. Let's see, once again, between 11 a.m. and 3, museum galleries will be open as well.
And you don't even have to bring your own flowers. That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I know. I know. Just bring yourself.
And then many people use only a fraction of what their smartphone allows them to do, right?
Like me, yes.
Yeah, me too.
There's a class on Maui to teach you how to get more out of your smartphone. So bring your smartphone and you'll learn the basics, like how to download apps, make phone calls, make video calls, text, send, and open attachments, use your camera, access Wi-Fi, and more. AARP is sponsoring this class in the Maui Coffee Attic tomorrow from 10 a.m. until noon. To register, visit the HPR website.
And you can practice downloading apps by downloading our Hawaii Public Radio app.
There you go.
How about that?
HPR.
And then we're hearing a concert from a rarely used instrument.
Yes, the organ.
Not something you can carry around.
No, not at all. Organist Joey Fala is a local boy. He's from Honolulu and is currently a master's student at Yale. He'll be in concert playing on the largest pipe organ in Hilo, which is located at the Higashi Honganji Mission on Mohouli Street in Hilo. And this is from 3 to 4:30 p.m. on Sunday. It's free, but donations are accepted.
They're amazing instruments because they take up the entire building, right?
Yes.
Yes. Spectacular sound. Thanks so much, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation at this point in every show to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more about them on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. when you talk about the hopes for prison reform and hopes for, you know, fighting the federal government's immigration policies, Hawaii is going to be at a very different place from where Washington, D.C. seems to be taking the country these days.
And a lot of people are very grateful for that fact.
Yeah.
And to see what Hawaii is doing to be leading some of that is hopeful for a lot of people, too, because so often Hawaii is so far away from the action that it seems almost sometimes irrelevant, except not this time and not for a lot of people and not with the way society has developed. We are just so mobile.
We might even be reaching the point where our very distance from the mainland is a kind of advantage, having created a pretty separate culture here.
A separate culture here, but one that also clearly engages with cultures around the world. When you think about, you know, global teams that interact for business, people coming here from different places around the world, families now that are not living anywhere near where some of their nuclear family members might be, and just the general sensitivities that we have in Hawaii.
Well, let's hope it does us some good, right?
We'll know. We'll know in a week. And as we're talking about next week, coming up on Monday, civil rights are on our agenda. ACLU's Ben Weisner will be here for a panel of talks affiliated with UHM Kennedy Theater's production of Smile, You're Under Surveillance. And William Hoshijo, the executive director of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, will talk about the uptick in anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant attacks.
And we'll look at how locally produced fiction can offer insights in today's government and culture.
If you want to give us some of your insights, you can do that by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. On Facebook, we're at Hawaii Conversation. On Twitter, at HI Conversation. And you can find me on Twitter at BKOZHPR.
Download HPR's new app on Google Play or find it at the iTunes Store. Listen back to any of our past conversations. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program, and Ryan Finnerty is our production assistant.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkuhl.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back on Monday and pick up the conversation. Enjoy your weekend.